Welcome to the 94th episode of Reverse Rope Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
It's 11 years to the day that the Pakistan team refused to take the field at the Oval after being accused of ball tampering. Welcome to the podcast that never really fancies doing any exercise after the tea break.
I'm actually sitting here with a glass of ginger beer recording this podcast, you know, which feels like a very kind of cricket tea break kind of thing. I don't know. I don't think I've ever had ginger beer as part of a cricket tea break.
That's a real British summer days thing, isn't it?
Well, I'm drinking it because I'm horribly hungover, and I find that the kind of sugar and the ginger at the back of the throat kind of helps. But anyway, there we go. Tea breaks through the ages. What are we going to be talking about today? We've got a little bit of a review of the last couple of weeks. Of course, the remarkable England West Indies three-day test that's just concluded. We're going to be talking about the rather beautiful cricket ground in Galle in Sri Lanka, for no good reason other than it's very beautiful. And we're also going to be reviewing Emma John's book following on. Now, talking of tea, Andy, you had a particularly fine tea recently, I hear.
I have. It was spectacular, actually. I will go into details. So the occasion was last Sunday, I had the honour of umpiring in the Dan Lucas Memorial Match, the inaugural Dan Lucas Memorial Match. Dan tragically died at the age of just 31 earlier this year. He was a passionate and independent-minded sports and music writer who I had the pleasure to get to know through Guerrilla Cricket. The day was a complete triumph, a lovely game played in a great spirit, glorious South London sunshine, rather unexpected after what had been quite a sort of flaky
win. Where was it?
It was at Elaine's Club, which was a new one to me, in sort of near Herne Hill. And it's one of these grounds that has a railway bridge in the background, which is kind of wonderful. So you've got this kind of very bucolic country setting, and then this slightly sort of industrial backdrop with trains, you know, cracking through every now and then. It's
like those old games in the north of England, you know, with the colliery heap in
the
background.
It is. It's a nice balance. I always think it's the sort of same thing at the Oval. You know, you've got the sort of cricket pitch and then the big
gas holders
in the background. And yes, then there was this tea. I mean, really, it had it all. You know, we had the cucumber sandwiches. We had scones, the size of which they were extraordinary. You had one of them, and it was about four normal scones. You know, the fielding team kind of staggered out afterwards. It really was something
special.
Yeah,
I was going to say, how did this affect the game? Because it usually does affect the game quite considerably.
Fortunately, the whole game was being played quite sort of gently. I think for the bowlers in particular, it was a big ask to expect them to come out and bowl after that tea. God, and I've just had a flashback as well. Quiche as well, this stunning smoked salmon quiche. I was actually disappointed about how sort of poor an effort I was able to put in, because really I wanted everything, but by about two-thirds of the way down I could sort of barely stand.
Now, talking about poor efforts, I came across this mention of this game on Twitter where you seemed to have been being particularly lambasted by presumably people playing for some of your umpiring decisions.
I was heavily criticised for not giving a stumping, where the consensus of keeper and slips was that the batsman was out a long way around. I would put money that I was right. I would tell you the keeper did not move quite as quickly as he thought he did, and the batsman actually got back quite quickly. So there you go.
And it's one of the great things about these kinds of games is that you will just no one will ever know.
No,
there are these things that happen, no replays, they happen in the split second, in the moment, and you can never actually go back and review that. It's one of the great things about kind of amateur cricket.
My big umpiring challenge, actually, I should say very quickly, was a member of the, I think it was really the Guardian 11, came on to bowl and had the most obvious chucking action ever, but it was not seen as a sort of diplomatic thing to do. So I had a kind of quiet word with the captain. I can't name any names, and he and the captain very said no, I'll take him off at the end of the over. So a diplomatic incident was avoided. But I think on finishing on a more serious
was
it note,
Vic Marks?
No, it wasn't. Sadly, he didn't put in an appearance. But I think it was a great example that despite the very sad background to the occasion and the sadness clearly felt by many who were there, the day still managed to pay tribute to Dan in an utterly joyous way. And I think that says a lot for everyone involved and also for the sport of cricket.
And is he? And is this going to be an annual thing? Is
That's
that
the
the idea?
plan. Yeah, that's the plan, and I hope it does. And I think after the success of this one, I think there would certainly be enthusiasm for to do it again. I realize I've sort of gone on a long way, but there's one thing I should actually mention before we finish, which is that it's fair to say that some of Dan's music journalist colleagues were perhaps a little less qualified than some of his, cricket writing colleagues. And there was one guy who has gone semi-viral on Twitter because, having been reminded by his captain to bring a box, he turned up with a large cardboard box. And the image of him standing there, at last count, I think, has been sort of retweeted kind of 800 times or something. So, yes, congratulations.
What was he planning to do with said box?
Well, I think, I suppose if you've never played cricket before and someone tells you to turn up and says, "Oh, you must bring a box," I suppose it's actually quite a rational way to behave, isn't it? I mean, if you don't really know what you've let yourself in for.
No, you just thought, I'm game for this. I'm up for anything. I'll take part. And if they tell me that that's what you need, that's what you need.
I think there was some excellent gameness all round. I think that there was several people batting who had never batted before, who came with techniques that would not have been seen in any manual, but in some cases were surprisingly effective.
Remarkably effective. That box could probably have been quite effective to take away some of the teas to have for lunch for the next week, I reckon. That's what I would have done.
I
Smuggled
know,
away some of those
doggy bags.
scones.
I'm never sure really what the ethics around doggy bags and tea are. But well, on to a couple of cricketers who sadly are of the kind of level of professionalism where they're not allowed to eat their own body weight at tea. You've been thinking England.
I have been thinking England. So, one of the problems of day-night tests, they may be all very well for those in England who want to, be able to get on the beers hard and carry on through into the night. One of the problems is that when you're trying to listen to these tests from Australia, it coincides exactly with ours when you really do, if you want to maintain any kind of professional outlook on life during a working week, actually have to be asleep. So I've actually mostly been following the test by just kind of, reading up on it the morning after. And frankly, a bit of a disappointment that this game only took 3 days. And actually, reading the book that we've been reading for the podcast, which is a book about, obviously we'll talk about it more later, it's a book about England cricketers in the 90s. It suddenly struck me just how far we had come and how far the cricketers, cricketers we knew it growing up in the 90s, how far that was from a situation that we now have, where in two articles I was reading this morning, you have this kind of strange mutual admiration club within the England set up. So first Alastair Cook came out and described Joe Root as the greatest England batsman ever. And then Joe Root came out a little bit later on and was talking about how what an amazing thing it was to be playing alongside the now two leading England Test wicket takers, Jimmy Anderson and Stuart Broad. I find something a bit kind of sickly about this mutual congratulation society. And of course, when you've beat a team inside 3 days and taken 19 wickets in a day, it's kind of easier to be a bit like that. But you suddenly realise how far this England side has come when you have this team where everyone actually considers themselves lucky to be playing with one another.
Yeah, and I guess it's based on ability, but it's also based on genuine affection. There does seem to be, a lot of the team do seem to genuinely like each other, which I know also, as we'll get onto with the book later, I think is always a lot easier when the team is winning. I do also sometimes wonder occasionally whether some of these quotes aren't the product of just too many bloody interviews. You get
Yeah,
to a
you've got to
stage
say
where
something
Alistair
else. Yep,
Cook is
yep.
like, "What the hell do I say now? I've been interviewed for the 10th time this week. I'll go over the top and describe Joe Root as the best batsman ever," which maybe he
But
might turn into.
it is the dream, though, isn't it? An Australian friend of mine texted me yesterday about Cook's innings, and it is kind of the dream what's happened now. If this goes on to actually, be more than a one series wonder, the fact that Cook loses the captaincy and seems to have taken on a new life with the bat, maybe Root gets the captaincy, it doesn't seem to have affected his batting in any way at all. In fact, the responsibility seems to have improved him. I mean, it does look like it could be a formula that that really works out. Touch wood, famous last words.
On
They're
the
now never
other
going to make another
side,
bun between them.
on the other side of this dream, however, there was something of a nightmare.
There's always a loser. Yeah, there's always a loser when there's a winner. Now, how does that go down with a Windies fan such as yourself?
Yeah, I mean, it was well known for a long time. I used to have almost a regular slot on this podcast where I would seize on any half decent West Indies performance and confidently declare that this was the start of a renaissance. Sadly, I have nothing to work with from the last 3 days. The expectations ahead of this series were exceptionally low. In fact, I don't think I've seen a series as poorly anticipated in England as this one. There really was zero sort of... I mean, credit to the good people of Birmingham and others who've turned up and sold those first 3 days out. But more generally in the media, there was no enthusiasm for this. But West Indies failed to meet even those incredibly low expectations. They were abject with bat, ball and in the field. There's been a lot of talk about whether this is a new low, this innings and 207 run defeat, and it set me off sort of digging around a few old scorecards, and I realised that actually, not quite exactly, but 10 years ago, the West Indies lost by an innings and 83 runs at Headingley. Again, there they scored less than 150 in both innings. I mean, actually, funnily enough, the other parallel is that with Cook getting a double 100 here, KP got an incredibly easy double 100 in that game. I guess the point is that where they haven't necessarily got much worse from then, what we then considered a one-off nadir has become a permanent state of affairs, and I think that's incredibly depressing, not just for the future of West Indies cricket, but for the future of Test cricket. I think we are now looking squarely at the inevitable prospect of two-tier Test cricket, because barring something exceptional, this series is going to be awful.
Well, there you go. You heard it. You heard it here first. You should go and join the ICC as their Test cricket publicity person. You know how to spin a story and make Test cricket sound good. So no, it is. It definitely does feel like the West Indies, particularly when you look at this team, it's not so much that they don't have players who are hugely experienced. You also look at those players and think, even if they had more experience, I'm not certain that they'd be great Test players. It's really difficult now, actually, to see a way back from
this.
Well,
I had a discussion with some people the other day, and we asked the question, where would this West Indies team sit in county cricket? And the most optimistic view was that they would be at the top of Division 2. There was no one who could make the case for them competing as a top division county, which I think is pretty damning, actually. And you've been looking at another way in which Test cricket is being, devalued, I guess.
Yeah, so I mean, God, it's something that we seem to return to a fair bit, one way or other. It's the demise of Test cricket. I was, you know, saddened to read a story over the last week about South Africa's forthcoming Test. So every year, the biggest home Test in the South African season are the Boxing Day and the New Year's Test. It's when everyone is on a public holiday. It's when, you know, there's the biggest buzz around cricket. It's when they play their biggest matches. And it's when, frankly, they make their most money for Test cricket. They're due to play India this year, which would, of course, be huge. But actually, they've just cancelled the Boxing Day Test, and they think the New Year's Day Test, I think 2nd of January, is going to be cancelled as well. And that's because of some, you know, the idiot who sits down and moves counters around on a calendar has managed to completely muck it up. India were playing Sri Lanka just before. They don't actually finish the Sri Lanka series until just before Christmas. And so in a way, understandably, India have come out and said, look, we can't start another series 3 days later. But really, it's just another indication of the fact that something that really cannot be that difficult as Test match scheduling. You know, you've only got eight countries to work around the board. Is it eight countries? I think it is. To work around the board. Actually, sitting down and working out how they can all play each other at a certain interval and it all slots in really is kind of a GCSE geography project. It really shouldn't be something so complex that we're getting to the stage that matches are having to be cancelled this late on. What it inevitably means as well is that, again, Test cricket is just deprioritized under other forms of cricket. Now, interestingly, South Africa are actually trying to make the best of the situation by looking to play a one-off test against an emerging nation. There's talk that it may even be Ireland that they
play amazing,
against
wouldn't
for
it?
The
yeah.
for the Boxing Day test, which would be fantastic. But it shouldn't really be left to kind of individual countries to be trying to desperately to find these ways to keep Test cricket alive.
I mean, the old story here is one of power imbalance, which is that, you know, India, Australia, England hold the cards really in terms of scheduling. Anyone playing India will make more money out of that series, Ashes excepted, than any other series they will play, which means India set the terms. And you know, to be fair to them, they are under sort of heavy demand as a result of that to play a lot of test matches. But a simple world in which we all played each other the same amount of times is probably not beyond the wit of man. From the archives, and in this episode, Toby will be introducing us to one of the most spectacular grounds in all of cricket.
So it's winter here in Australia, and it's been a relatively mild winter, but when winter comes along, you spend a lot of time kind of musing where you're going to go in the sun on a bit of a holiday at some point when you've got some money together. And I was sitting down and talking to my girlfriend about this, and we were thinking of a few options, and one of the things we always look for in a holiday is somewhere to go and, you know, actually do stuff rather than just lying on a beach going and seeing stuff and doing lots of eating and drinking and walking and that kind of thing. And Sri Lanka was something that I suggested, and my partner Amelia kind of suddenly said, yeah, that's such a good idea. All of the stuff we love doing, all of the eating and drinking and walking and everything, perfect. And I actually had to admit to her that the reason why I wanted to go to Sri Lanka wasn't specifically for any of those reasons, but particularly to go to one individual cricket ground, the Gaul Cricket Stadium. I should call it the Gaul Cricket Ground, because it really is not a stadium. It is one of the most beautiful grounds in the world, when there are those sort of forums and internet articles and things that name the most beautiful cricket grounds in the world. It's often up there right at the top. It's the one that not only sits right on the Pacific with the sparkling ocean behind the grass banks, but it also has a fort in the background, giving it a particularly iconic and distinctive status. And so on the back of that, in trying to decide to persuade Amelia that this is somewhere we should go on holiday, I decided that I'd look up the history of this beautiful ground and try and tempt her with some of that. And so that's the thing that I want to talk about on the podcast today.
It's one of the few cricket grounds outside of the UK that when you mention to English cricket fans, they will all have an image in their head. And I think you mentioned the ocean, which is a key part of it, but really it is about the fort. You have these... every cricket fan will have these images of their head of people actually watching cricket from the fort. And it is a spectacular backdrop. And I guess it always has this slight thing to it of, you know, England cricket and England's colonial history are all kind of interwoven. And there's something very colonial about that image as well in some ways.
There it is, and in fact, that is indeed the history of that fort. You teed that up very nicely. Is absolutely steeped in quite remarkable colonial history. So that fort was first built by the Portuguese in 1588. The Portuguese were the first people to the first non-Sri Lankans to invade Sri Lanka, and then the fort was extended by the Dutch in the 17th century, and it's actually a UNESCO World Heritage Site. One of actually, you know, only a few sites globally that have got World Heritage status. And the reason for that is because, actually, as you're saying, it kind of brings together colonial European architecture and also South Asian architecture in a way that is apparently very particularly unique and cohesive. Usually it would just be a case of, you know, the Portuguese going out there and building a fort exactly like the kind of forts they'd have in Lisbon, but for various reasons, actually, there's a bit of a joining together of European and distinctively natively Sri Lankan architectures there. And apparently the other reason why the fort is so remarkable is because it's so well maintained. It's obviously you know, 400, 500 years old by now, but it's always been kept in brilliant conditions, as much as anything, because the Sri Lankans have always known that it is iconic and it is one of those things that, exactly as you're saying, puts a place on the map, a little bit like the Sydney Opera House here in Sydney. When you have somewhere, a venue that is iconic, it gives meaning, international meaning, to a place as well.
It does suggest an impressive amount of forethought, actually, because, you know, all over the world, countries have sort of started taking the idea of heritage seriously at different points. And actually, for, you know, large numbers of countries, the whole idea of heritage and of it being important to preserve places actually has come, you know, quite late. The idea that something built as early as 1588 was being carefully preserved and looked after in Sri Lanka, does suggest a reasonable amount of forethought.
So obviously, back in 1588, cricket was not being played in the shadow of Gaul Fort. Cricket actually, you know, wasn't really being played anywhere at that point, and it wasn't brought to Sri Lanka as a whole until 1832. Obviously, it was again British colonialists who brought the game of cricket to Sri Lanka. But even back then, in the mid 19th century, it wasn't actually cricket that was being played under the shadow of Gaul Fort. It was actually there was a race course there with a huge grandstand. Apparently, racing was the kind of sport of the moment in Sri Lanka, in South Sri Lanka, in the 19th century. And in 1876, this enormous race course opened there. And that actually is, obviously, the good thing about race courses is that they're round. And so the creation of that ground, that round ground under the fort itself, actually paved the way quite nicely for a cricket ground, obviously of the same shape, to be put there. So it was actually in 1927 that the ground was officially named as a cricket stadium. Apparently, informal cricket games were happening there quite a lot before then, but in 1927 there was more cricket being played than racing, so they finally made the call to actually turn it into a cricket stadium. And in 1945, a turf wicket was introduced, and the ground became home to the Gaul Cricket Club and really became a cricket club proper.
It's interesting how these things are almost quite democratic, isn't it? I guess had horse racing clung on and been more popular, we would never have been talking about this. I suppose one sport eventually just overwhelms the other, and that's that. And then, you know, you establish the tradition and it's still there, you know, X number of years later.
Exactly, and certainly after 1945, when the Gaul Cricket Club was set up, it kind of absolutely carried on building this reputation for the beauty of the ground as a place for touring, you know, teams to come and play, and more than anything, as a paradise for spin bowlers. So it was where it was on this ground that Shane Warne took his 500th Test wicket. And the Sri Lankan team actually, you know, had an unusual amount of success on this ground, particularly with their specialist spinners that have, you know, characterised their team since they started playing Test cricket. It's actually in the first Test at the ground, which is in 1998 against New Zealand, was a bit of a sign of things to come when Sri Lanka won by an innings and every single one of their wickets was taken by spinners, and that really does say something about the nature of a pitch. Now, in 2004, disaster struck not only for you know, Gaul Cricket Ground, but for a lot of that part of the world and many of the people in it, when the earthquake and subsequent tsunami struck that part of the world, and it destroyed a huge amount of coastal Sri Lanka, and particularly down at the southern end of Sri Lanka, which is where Gaul is, was particularly badly hit. Now, remarkably, the fort actually, you know, carried on standing. It's amazing sometimes how those, you know, sometimes it's the oldest buildings that are the ones that managed to survive through all of this. And actually, the ground was, because it's on slightly higher ground from the rest of Gaul, was actually pressed into service as a temporary shelter and helipad for lots of the communities around to come together and kind of shelter there. And once the initial emergency, as it were, of the tsunami had passed, there was actually a bit of a reluctance to rebuild the ground, as much as anything, because obviously there were so many communities across Sri Lanka that had been completely destroyed, and suddenly this sense of, well, where do our priorities lie? Is it actually in rebuilding remote villages, or is it on a cricket ground? But actually, what then happened was quite interesting, because rather than actually spending public money on it, they actually did a private fundraising campaign, so that money wasn't being siphoned away from the rebuilding effort elsewhere, and that it was a private campaign that actually went towards getting this cricket ground back together. Not least because people realised how important it was to have this kind of unifying, you know, Sri Lanka is cricket mad, and to have this unifying place where the nation could try and actually, you know, foster some sort of good spirits after this massive disaster. Interestingly, Shane Warne gave a huge amount of money to the rebuilding of it, possibly because he had happy memories there, having taken his 500th Test wicket. Ian Botham also, who I don't know how he got on there, actually, I have to say, but he also donated a significant amount of money to the rebuilding.
It's one of those interesting situations where you can completely see in the immediate calculations why should we be spending money on a cricket ground. But that's, sport falls into this strange space that we've often commented on, that it's kind of, it's meaningless in the grand scheme of things, and yet so vital. And actually, at a time when so much has fallen and is in need of something exciting and something to unite around, that is where sport can play a role. So I think it's
absolutely
wonderful.
You know, it's the same argument that's had around the arts as well. I mean, we see it in, I mean, completely different context, but we see it in America at the moment and that model around funding of the arts, and absolutely the power of sport to you know, particularly as I was saying, somewhere like Sri Lanka where it's such a national game, the power of sport to bring people together is really, really significant. And indeed, so when the renovations finally began in 2006, there was really a sense that this ground needed to become the central sign of Gaul's resilience and its rebirth after the tsunami. And when it reopened in 2007, it was a moment of, you know, great national significance for Sri Lanka, not least because the country was in the midst of a civil war at the time as well. And the president of Sri Lanka actually did the reopening of the ground. And it's, if you look at the, you know, read the reports of it and look at the footage, it was clearly, you know, a massive ceremonial occasion. It wasn't just a sort of little, you know, cutting of a ribbon and then everyone shuffles off to, you know, goes to the next function. It was really, really a huge thing. Just as a side note, there's quite an amusing story about the photographer Phil Brown, who we've actually interviewed on this podcast, who was there at the ground. When he was at the ground for the reopening, he hadn't realized quite what a significant moment this was going to be, and so he'd sort of not really been paying attention. But then he suddenly realized, you know, he saw the number of people who were there and, you know, felt the kind of emotionally fraught atmosphere, and suddenly realized that he needed to get there and take some photos and things like that. And because there was a civil war on at the time, there was security everywhere, and there was this, you know, guy, and he you know, he's a bit of a ramshackle looking guy with bags galore of camera equipment over his shoulders, and he describes the moment where he charges across the ground towards the prime minister to get the photo before realizing that he's probably about to be gunned down himself by, you know, by a security sniper on the roof, because this probably did consist of a pretty enormous security threat. So since that reopening in 2007, the Gaul Stadium has continued to be obviously a great place for tourists to go. It's become one of the, you know, places for fans when you go and follow your team. It's one of the places that you go to, and it's also continued to be, you know, the ground was not wrecked by the tsunami when it comes to the spinners. Muralitharan played his last game at the ground and took his 800th wicket there. And in 2017, it was in Gaul that Ranganathan became the highest wicket-taking spinner in Test cricket, surpassing Daniel Vittori's 262 wickets. So certainly, it seems that the ground, despite the events of the last decades, its spirit definitely wasn't going to die. To the review, and for this episode we have been reading Following On, a memoir of teenage obsession and terrible cricket by Emma John, published by Bloomsbury just last year, so hot off the press, published in 2016. Now Emma John, for those of you who haven't come across her, is, according to her biography in the book, a writer and editor for The Guardian and The Observer, and she's been doing that for more than 10 years. She's a former deputy editor of Observer Sports Monthly and The Wisden Cricketer. In 2008, she was the first woman to win a sports journalism award. She lives in North London and has been on the MCC waiting list for 17 years, 6 months and 21 days, not that she's counting. Now, Andy, how far did this book chime with your experience of being a cricket fan?
I'm slightly younger, although not much younger, I don't think, than Emma John, which means that the times she's describing, the sort of mid-90s or early 90s kind of real tragedies of English cricket, were when I was first getting into the game, but I wasn't sort of quite able to be as fully involved as she was, perhaps. So I remember, for example, England being bowled out for 70-odd, and at that point not quite appreciating how horrendous that was, because, you know, in the cricket that I was playing as a kid, being bowled out for 70-odd wasn't the end of the world.
It was fantastic, yes.
Of course, you know, when Australia was sort of 500 in response, I realised that maybe there was an issue. What certainly chimed with me is her confidence throughout this period that England would turn it around. I remember, even at this stage, watching and sort of reading about it and just assuming that it was a matter of time before, you know, England would start winning things. By the time we got to sort of 99 and that famous defeat to New Zealand, at which point I was a little bit older and a little bit more sort of involved and aware, I was realising that this might never happen.
And it is, I mean, it's something that is distinctive to both youth and sort of sports fandom, you know, really, really hardcore sports fandom. That kind of completely diehard attitude whereby your team can do no wrong. At one point in the book, she talks about the fact that, you know, while she and her mother, so her mother, who is the person who actually introduces her to cricket and lived through a lot of the cricket of her childhood with her, while she and her mother can happily, you know, criticise her team and talk about how useless England players are and everything like this, no one else can. And that remarkable attitude of, you know, that you have to own your own the failures of your own team somehow.
Yes, I think that real dislike of people who were not emotionally involved putting the England team down. It was like, no, I'm involved, I'm committed, I can insult them, but not you. Another thing about the sort of fan experience that definitely chimed with me is this point around how sport can mean more in times of sort of personal or political trouble. She talks about a sort of painful breakup and then watching a cracking England-South Africa game and how by the end of it, you know, she was barely thinking of the breakup at all. And I think I can certainly think of occasions where sort of, you know, life has been tricky and then you watch some cricket and you forget about it. And I think also, it's amazing how many people I feel I've spoken to in the last year or so who have said that with times of sort of political turmoil, they've found sport more meaningful to them than ever before. You know, at a time of, you know, Trump, Brexit, blah, 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 that they find sport more and more a kind of refuge.
Well, I was going to say, so Emma John's book Following On, basically, which is about her, I mean, the subtitle, A Memoir of Teenage Obsession and Terrible Cricket, is really a book of two halves. It's a book about a girl growing up during the 90s being what they call in Australia a cricket tragic, and her obsession with the game and what that was like growing up to be a cricket obsessive, and particularly her liking for Michael Atherton. The other half of the book is the fact that in writing this book, 15, 20 years on, she actually tracks down a lot of the key players of the 90s period, and she goes and meets them. And there are these wonderful moments where what she does is she matches up her, you know, her really sort of finely etched opinions of these players as they came to her kind of teenage imagination with what these people are actually like 20 years on, and talks to them about their experience of having been part of that England team. Were there surprises in terms of those players, do you think?
I think there were. I think the thing that was not surprising was the general view of the England setup. I think that was the least surprising thing, but it was interesting to see the way it was expressed. So I think the general consensus is that, you know, English cricket was a mess in the 90s, central contracts were introduced, Nasser Hussain, Duncan Fletcher got involved, and suddenly, you know, we started turning it around, and we had the success that the 2000s brought. And you know, really through to the present day, you know, there's an interesting comment from Phil Tufnell saying there was never a feeling of all of us moving towards a goal. It was just turn up, play, and go home. It was all ad hoc, and very interesting again on this whole policy of, you know, inconsistent selection. Mark Ramprakash talking about I was never quite able to feel part of the England team, and at one point, you know, there's discussion around the fact that actually, you know. When a guy failed in the team, you know, he went out and batted and, you know, came back for naught, a little part of you would be thinking, oh, well, that's my place a bit safer for next week. And you can see how that's never going to
Well,
lead to
yeah, and
success.
compared to that attitude that we were talking about earlier in the England team, where everyone's feeding off one another's success, the fact that you actually feel better when someone else fails than when they succeed really does not
Is
talk to a
not
particularly
encouraging.
viable team culture. I mean, it's something that Andy Caddick talks a bit about in the when Emma goes and sees him in a quite remarkable interview. Andy Caddick talks about the fact that, you know, he never really felt safe in the team and how up to, you know, he was playing until he was 40, I think, for Somerset, and after that moment, he felt like he was the best player in the country, and yet he'd been dumped by England. I mean, the Caddick interview is a particularly remarkable one because he comes across as having absolutely no firm grip of reality. In a way, the way that he's looking back 20 years on at the 1990s, he actually comes out and claims that the team, the England team of the 1990s, would have beaten the England team of the 2010s, which, you
Not
know, on the
just
face of it seems like a
5-0. So he believes the England
There
of the
we
90s
go.
would have whitewashed. I mean, what he's done there is he's taken an argument that a lot of people, I think, would have sympathy for, which is that the England of the 90s were up against some serious sides. I mean, that Australia side, but also things like, you know, Wachi Yunus and Awasim Akram in Pakistan. But he's taken it a little bit too far. But it's a key thing that the book's all about, really, is how all these different players remember it. Because actually, by the time Emma John's going and speaking to them, it's all kind of 2 decades on. I find really interesting the players who have kind of made their peace or just distanced themselves from it. So Emma John says of John Crawley, his sporting past doesn't seem to hang on him the way it might a player who's gone into the media and coaching. Just interesting because Crawley's someone who, a huge promise, never really lived up to it. It would be easy to imagine him having a lot of angst and regret. In reality, she paints a picture of a man who's gone to the country, has a very happy life, and frankly, it doesn't play a big part in his thinking anymore.
And that is part of the skill of this book, I think, is the pen portraits of some of the players and the way that she goes and visits them in their current setting. So, you know, when she goes to see Alex Stewart, she goes down to the Oval to Surrey and meets him in the office there in the middle of a game. And actually, these kind of contexts that the players have now put themselves in are really interesting. You know, as she says, John Crawley, who's now, I think, a teacher at a school, has absolutely no connection in a way to cricket. The Atherton one is really, really interesting because Atherton just comes across as I mean, to my mind, kind of as a really sort of class act almost, in the sense that he sort of, you know, when she says to him the opening question, I think is, do you think the team of the 90s was, you know, unfairly judged? And he sort of runs through a few statistics to talk about, you know, to talk about it, and then sort of turns the question back onto her, and you suddenly realize that is why Atherton was such a good captain and is such a good kind of pundit now. Is the sheer kind of class and restraint and insight with which he answers that question, as opposed to someone like a Caddick who just wants, you know, has an axe to grind.
But Atherton's interesting as well in that, not unlike Crawley, he talks about, he says, I don't look back on my career at all unless I'm forcibly asked to, which I found quite astonishing. And you can also see the gap between him and Emma John, you know, for whom, as a fan, she thinks that back on this period very frequently, and remembers it a lot. There are inevitably, with all these excellent interviews, some wonderful kind of anecdotes and moments. I think my personal favourite is the recollection of Jack. Well, it was really Atherton's incredible performance in Johannesburg, that sort of stoic 180 odd to save that test match. And Jack Russell was his partner for much of this. And Jack Russell kept saying to Atherton during this partnership, remember Barbados, which was supposed to remind Atherton of an occasion where England had come within 10 minutes of saving a test and had failed. And at the end of the game, Atherton says to Russell, you kept saying something about Barbados. And Russell says, oh, you know, it was like in Barbados and I wanted us not to make the same mistake. And Atherton said, well, I wasn't there. I didn't play in that game. So to all intents and purposes, Russell had just been shouting out the name of a Caribbean island for no reason for most of the innings. I did also like, and I know this is slightly playing up to his cliche image, but when Tufnell turns up to the interview and declares it's the end of a bank holiday weekend, and he just says, "It's just a license to go and get smashed. Life is too bloody short not to when you've got Monday off." So there you go.
I think one of the things I found when reading this is actually, you know, the idea of going and sitting down and having a, you know, an honest chat with your heroes and asking them about what actually went on, you know, when you've seen everything from the past, from the outside. That's a kind of dream scenario in many ways. And I found myself actually finding that Emma John asks kind of the same questions that I would have asked, and that's a really, really satisfying thing in a book. And I certainly, you know, the other thing that I found about this book is that it's actually just well written and very, very readable because of it as well. I think we both kind of roared through it in record time. So that is Following On by Emma John. I think we both heartily recommend it. It's published now. You can get it on the internet or from good old fashioned bookshops or on Kindle, if that's what you do as well. And that concludes the 94th episode, there we go, of Reverse Web Radio. Thank you for joining us again. As ever, you can have a rant over on Twitter at Reverse Web, and we'll be back in another fortnight or so with more cricketing goodness.